Now from the KSFR newsroom, At Noon looks at the top local news headlines for this Friday, October 25th.
The New Mexico Legislative Finance Committee has been given updates on two separate inquiries into fraud allegations against in-state providers of mental health and substance abuse services. The allegations caused the Human Services Department to cut off Medicaid payments to the providers back in June. New Mexico Attorney General Gary King told the LFC Thursday that his inquiry could possibly conclude by the end of the year. State Auditor Hector Balderas was less committal on his separate review, though he will issue his required annual audit of the Human Services Department in mid-December. Santa Fe's city attorney will start a new job November 1st. The Santa Fe Public Schools has announced that Gino Zamora will become its general counsel then. Mayor Koss provided his good wishes to the outgoing Zamora, citing the attorney's efforts on city annexation, marriage equality, and day-to-day municipal business. The school district says Zamora will work to internalize the district's legal contracts and expenses, which will result in greater administrative efficiency and reduced legal costs for the district. Drunk driving arrests are up in New Mexico's third largest city, and it's planning a community forum on the issue tomorrow. The Rio Rancho Observer says DWI arrests in the City of Vision went up 56% from 2011 to 2012. Saturday's forum, organized by Rio Rancho judges Robert Cook and Richard Zanotti, is set for 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Rio Rancho City Hall. Santa Fe mayoral hopeful Javier Gonzalez has announced that his campaign has qualified for public financing. All of the other mayoral hopefuls have indicated that they, too, are seeking to go the publicly funded route for the March municipal elections. To qualify, candidates need to obtain 600 donations of $5 from registered Santa Fe voters who live anywhere in the city. The deadline is November 18th. The former president of Santa Fe Community College, Sheila Ortego, has been named interim president of Pima Community College in Tucson, Arizona. Ortego served as president of Santa Fe Community College from 2006 through 2012. Ortego, who earned her doctoral and master's degrees from the University of New Mexico, takes her new post at the Tucson School after the former president there resigned amid complaints about his leadership. Santa Fe County conducts an unwanted prescription drug turn-in drive tomorrow. A collaboration among multiple law enforcement agencies as well as the Drug Enforcement Agency, the aim is to prevent prescription drug abuse by collecting expired, unused, and unwanted pharmaceuticals. In Santa Fe proper, Albertson's grocery stores at DeVargas Center and on Zafferano will serve as anonymous disposal locations. An emergency salvage order from the Department of Game and Fish, in effect now through Friday, November 1st, allows for catching and keeping an unlimited number of trout. It applies only to a two-mile stretch of the Santa Fe River between Paseo de Peralta and Camino O'Leary. The order comes as the Santa Fe River is about to run dry and was recently stocked with 500 fish for the Children's Fishing Derby. Anglers 12 and older must have a valid fishing license. Governor Martinez announces two new initiatives today geared toward hiring unemployed military veterans. One will seek to fill openings in the trucking industry, the other within the emergency medical service fields. The governor will present the hiring plans at a luncheon at Albuquerque's National Guard Armory, honoring employers who have made a special outreach to veterans. Weather for Santa Fe, mostly cloudy today, a high near 60, and a 60% chance for showers and thunderstorms. Rain chances will decrease to 40% this evening to just under 20% for Saturday under partly sunny skies. Expect sunny and dry conditions on Sunday with highs in the low 60s. I'm Tom Tropebridge, KSFR News.
Thank you, Tom. And taking a look at Wall Street at midday, all the major indices in positive territory. The Dow currently up 30 points at 15,540. The NASDAQ is up 12 at 3,941. And the S&P 500 is up 4 at 1,756. Price of gold is up $2. It's trading at $1,352.30 per troy ounce. At noon on KSFR, we'll continue in just a moment.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by the Academy for the Love of Learning, presenting Life is What You Make It, a thought-provoking and inspiring concert and conversation with Peter Buffett, November 7th at the Linzik Performing Arts Center. The Academy for the Love of Learning's mission is to awaken, enliven, nurture, and sustain the natural love of learning in people of all ages. More information at aloveoflearning.org.
12 minutes past the hour as At Noon now segues to today's feature stories. This week, the New Mexico Municipal League has said it would like to see a restoration of a state tax on food to offset diminishing state subsidies for municipalities. The matter of a food tax in New Mexico is the stuff of history here in our state. To further explore the issue, we're joined now by Think New Mexico's Executive Director, Fred Nathan. Fred, you describe the organization you founded as a results-oriented think tank. You've also played a role in fighting taxes on food over the last decade. Give us some background on this issue.
So the food tax was actually implemented during the Great Depression. In fact, the first state to create a food tax was Mississippi, and New Mexico was second. Back then, state governments were funded almost entirely by property taxes. So during the Depression, property values plummeted, and so did governmental receipts. So state governments were scrambling for revenue, and Mississippi came up with the idea of taxing groceries. New Mexico implemented it, and if you look at the statute that was passed during the Great Depression, it came in as an emergency temporary tax, the emergency being the Great Depression. But yet it endured for about six decades after the Great Depression because, you know, once you put in a tax like that, people in government want to keep those revenues. So it took a long time, but in 2005, with the help of many people, we were able to get the tax on groceries repealed. And it's been a little bit like Rasputin. You know, we can't quite, it keeps coming back in different forms. Your listeners may remember the tortilla tax.
Yes, that was back in 2009, correct?
Right. So there, once again, during the Great Recession, there was a drop in governmental revenues, and the legislature, some legislators, wanted to bring back the tax on food, and the notorious tortilla tax was their idea. It was on many foods, including tortillas, and the public really rose up and said, no, this is not the right time to tax food. In fact, it's never a good time to impose a regressive tax on working families in New Mexico.
So we had a situation here where the food tax was finally eliminated in 2005, only to revisit the matter again just 4 years later. Who was behind that push for its reinstatement?
I think it came out of the leadership in the Senate, because they were scrambling and looking for revenues. And I think it was a senator named Bernadette Sanchez, and it actually passed the Senate and passed the House. And Governor Richardson was looking at it, and we were able to persuade him. It was part of a larger bill that he could line item veto it and sign the rest of the bill, and that's exactly what he did.
Now, we've heard that Governor Martinez is against reimposition of a tax on food, but the organization putting it forward anew, the New Mexico Municipal League, are they influential enough that you could expect to see some legislators begin to embrace the idea?
Yes, this is a very powerful organization, and in fact, I believe there's several people in the legislature who are mayors or former mayors. So they do, and the other thing that makes them powerful is that they represent the entire state, and of course they're mayors in all of these legislative districts. So they're going to get a fair hearing. But it's interesting, some people now within the Municipal League are pushing back. Jason Sandel, who is the son of Jerry Sandel, the former chairman of the Tax and Revenue Committee of the House of Representatives, said he wasn't polled when they made this decision. He's a city councilor in Farmington. And so I think more and more we're going to be hearing from mayors and city councilors who want to disassociate themselves with that organization's decision.
The reason given for bringing back a food tax is to supply more revenues to cities and towns as state subsidies decrease. Your thoughts?
The net effect of what the mayors and city councilors want to do would really, in effect, be a transfer of wealth from working low and middle class families to Walmart. And your listeners may be scratching your head and say, why Walmart? Well, Walmart is the largest grocery chain now in New Mexico. And something that a lot of people don't understand is when we used to tax food, the grocery stores were able to keep that tax revenue in their bank accounts for up to 56 days, and they got the interest off of that float. So the biggest beneficiary, if the mayors and city councilors are successful with this, will be Walmart. And the biggest loser will be working low and middle class families. And I just think this is sort of an interesting window into why New Mexico is always 49th or 50th in too many of these national rankings. And when we do make a little bit of progress, there's this sort of bizarre ambivalence about it. We should have repealed the food tax as we did in 2005 and moved on. That was progress.
And again, referencing Governor Martinez's stated opposition to the proposal, doesn't that make it unlikely the idea will get any real traction in the legislature?
Well, I hope so, but if you look historically, the legislature is very good at coming up with bargains and trades and backroom deals. I don't think the governor would go for any of them, but you never know what they're going to offer. So I think we have to prepare for a bill, and as we know from recent history, the legislature did pass a bill in 2009 or 10 where they were trying to bring back the food tax, the notorious tortilla tax. So it could happen again, and it went down to the wire with Governor Richardson, but he did the right thing in the end, and we would hope if history repeats that Governor Martinez would do the same thing and veto it.
Think New Mexico Executive Director Fred Nathan, many thanks for joining us here at noon on KSFR.
Santa Fe Art Institute hosts artist and cultural provocateur Dred Scott at SFAI. Scott's work stands on the lively boundaries between issues of polarization, exploitation, and intellectual development and participatory democracy. His exhibition entitled Money, Patriotism, Death, Polls, and Manifestos runs through November 22nd at SFAI. Learn more at sfai.org or call 424-5050. A message from the tax-exempt SFAI.
19 minutes past the hour as At Noon continues. Elder abuse is the topic of a conference currently being held in Albuquerque, which is being used to educate state personnel and others about the issue. Here with us today to discuss the problem and potential solutions is Gino Rinaldi, the New Mexico Secretary of Aging and Long-Term Services. Secretary Rinaldi, is elder abuse a big problem here in New Mexico?
Yes, it is. We have a number of people here at this conference that come from all over the spectrum with regards to. We have folks from the department, we have folks from law enforcement, we have folks from healthcare, hospitals, home health agencies, other departments like human services and Department of Health. And they're all working in concert to try to address the issue of adult abuse. In New Mexico, we take about 5,000 investigations, which are generated out of over 11,000 reports. And of those, we actually substantiate about 23%. Over 50% of those are self-neglect. Then we have abuse, and then we're seeing a huge increase in financial exploitation. One of the things that we're seeing is the severity of the report. In the past, we saw a lot of reports where, you know, there was a problem, and we'd go out and we'd investigate it, and we'd substantiate it, and we were able to, I would say, get in there and hopefully, you know, alleviate the problem. In today's reports, we're getting more and more where there is multiple problems associated with the report. It's requiring a lot more time, and, you know, frankly, the outcome is much more problematic for our elder or adult who has been reported.
Is an elderly person more likely to be abused by a family member or a stranger?
That's a family member. And I think one of the things that needs to be noted here is probably only 2 in 10 of the incidents are reported. So there's a lot of incidents of abuse, neglect, and exploitation that are occurring but do not get reported.
And is it a requirement to report elder abuse just as it currently is for child abuse?
Yes, it is. And oftentimes the problem is associated with, I think, a lack of understanding of what actually is abuse and what isn't. And I think that's where a lot of our difficulty lies. So we do a lot of education, and that's where this conference comes into play. We're actually educating our own folks on a lot of the changing environments. For instance, all the changes within healthcare. There's huge shifting with regards to the pharmaceutical problems associated with oxycodone and some of the opiate, you know, not just with the elders themselves taking them and then finding that they're having issues and falling and not eating and, you know, that type of stuff, thinking that they're just following the medical regime and they're having problems, but also they become targets of their other family members who are taking advantage of the fact that they have medication like that. And just that education really does help those in the field to do a better job and get the word out to not just the senior population, but the public in general.
Would you say the increase in the number of reports of elder abuse is due to an actual increase in incidents of abuse or merely better reporting?
Yeah, that's a difficult, I think, conclusion to draw. In my mind, I think very much the problem has been there. It's just with the aging population, with technology, and with the ability to start educating and getting people more informed about this issue, I think that has generated a lot more reporting and a lot more recognition of this as a problem, as well as law enforcement has become a critical player or partner in this, where in the past sometimes they looked at it as, well, it's a family issue, it's not really, you know, something we would deal with. Now they recognize it, and they're very, very strong partners, as well as district attorneys, the attorney general's office, you know, throughout the spectrum there. On the financial exploitation, I think the economic situation in this country has played a significant role in seeing an increase in that area. And then, like we say, with the increased aging population, you know, one of the fastest growing or the fastest growing cohort is the 80-plus population. And we know they are the most vulnerable, as well as, you know, they're also the statistic right now is 1 in 3 folks over 85 are suffering from dementia. And so, you know, with that comes a lot more risk for self-neglect. So those factors are all playing into it. Education and more people are aware, but also the fact that we're seeing an increase in aging population and then the economy. So we have to adjust to times, and I'm assuming that those would be some of the same statistics you would run into within the Child Protective Services world as well with regards to seeing increases.
And how do people report elder abuse?
Well, we have a call-in number for folks to report that. If they would call 1-866-654-3219, it's a central intake, and they can report suspicion of adult abuse or suspected.
Secretary Gina Rinaldi of Aging and Long-Term Services, many thanks for joining us here at noon on KSFR.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by PNM Resources Foundation and the PNM Fund, awarding more than $1 million since 2008 to New Mexico nonprofit organizations, helping them to decrease energy costs so they can invest more in their missions and programs. HomeWise Inc. in Santa Fe is one of the 57 Reduce Your Use grant recipients in 2013. To see all of the grant recipients, visit pnm.com/foundation.
This week, Governor Susana Martinez chaired a panel discussion on breast cancer in New Mexico. Many of the speakers were from the University of New Mexico Cancer Center. Here with a story for us is KSFR News reporter Charles Maynard.
Breast cancer is a top killer of women in New Mexico and across the country. Earlier this week, Governor Susana Martinez hosted a conference on breast cancer, which featured a number of speakers from the University of New Mexico Cancer Center. One of those speakers was Dr. Anna Voltura, a surgeon specializing in breast cancer treatment at UNM.
One thing that we need to remember is that close to 40% of our population is Hispanic ethnicity, and do tend to see a little higher rate in Hispanics, especially concerning advanced breast cancer. And part of that is because of access, both because of insurance reasons and, you know, number of physicians, and also because of the fact that we live in a rural state. So nationally, we compare with averages, other than that, when we do tend to see a lot more advanced breast cancer at presentation than other states. And again, that's just because of the ruralness of our state, and also we have less of a insured population.
She notes that for first-line treatment, surgery is still the best option.
To simplify it, we consider breast cancer a surgical disease in that it's something that we primarily treat with surgery by removing the cancer, removing the tumor. And in that respect, we use two different types of approaches. One is a lumpectomy, which is basically a partial mastectomy, just taking the tumor out, taking part of the breast out, and still leaving the breast. The other way we approach it is a mastectomy, removing the entire breast. So those are the two basic ways surgically we approach it. Those have changed significantly in the last several years as far as how we remove the breast, how we reconstruct the breast, different types of procedures to make sure that not only do we get rid of the cancer, but we also leave it looking good as well, that we get a good cosmetic result as well. And certainly we can't forget that our medical oncologists who, you know, help us out with chemotherapy and also with endocrine therapy, which is basically anti-hormone therapy. Those are essential as well.
Radiation does still play a major role in the treatment of the disease.
Radiation is a very big part if we're going to conserve the breast especially. And so if we do a lumpectomy and we just take out the tumor, that goes hand in hand with radiation. What has allowed us to do lumpectomies over the last several years for breast cancer is the fact that we have our radiation oncologist to help us out and to radiate the remainder of the breast tissue that we leave behind. And so that obviously is very essential as well.
At UNM, a great deal of research on breast cancer is ongoing.
You know, treatment research is certainly big. We've got a few things that we're looking at. A lot of the things that we're looking at aren't necessarily new medications, which there are some, but those have been ongoing. The biggest things here at UNM that we're looking at are mathematical models that will help us to determine how people are responding to chemotherapy early on. Is somebody doing well with the chemotherapy, or do we need to change it? There are a lot of things that are coming down that we're looking at for diagnosis. Unfortunately, we wish we were ahead of being able to diagnose. You know, still our mainstay is a mammogram. MRI is a great tool, but it's not for everybody, and it's not a screening test. So we don't really have things coming down as far as new techniques of how we're going to diagnose. But things that we're looking at are how do we minimize our surgery, how do we take out less tissue, how do we give less chemotherapy, still get some good results. So that's really what we're looking at. And of course, we're pushing access as far as trying to get women in sooner because, you know, early detection really is our mainstay as far as being able to catch it early and potentially even cure it.
Dr. Anna Voltura of the UNM Cancer Center. For KSFR Radio, I'm Charles Maynard.
Programming is underwritten in part by the New Mexico Land Conservancy, a nonprofit celebrating 11 years working with New Mexico landowners to preserve our land heritage by conserving the places they love. This year's Jane Wing Pachesky Conservation Award will be given to fourth-generation rancher Jim Winder at an upscale Western gala featuring Sid Masters and the Swing Riders and locally sourced food at the Farmers Market Pavilion on November 8th. To learn more, visit nmlandconservancy.org.
31 minutes past the hour as At Noon continues. Ensuring that children begin elementary school ready to learn is the goal of a newly announced partnership between the United Way of Santa Fe County and Santa Fe Public Schools. Rejoining us now here at the news desk is KSFR's Tom Trowbridge. And Tom, what do we know about in terms of elementary school readiness here in our state?
Well, Dan, unfortunately, it's really low, with an estimated 60% of New Mexico children who begin kindergarten a year to a year and a half behind.
And what will make this new partnership work?
Well, a lot. It's an ambitious undertaking, as you'll hear in my report. Through the combined efforts of the Santa Fe County United Way and Santa Fe School District, the Agua Fria Elementary School site will undergo a transformation and eventually become the Santa Fe Early Learning Center. Catherine Freeman is CEO of the United Way.
The idea here is to create on the Agua Fria School campus, you know, they're moving, the new school's being built, so that building will be vacated in May. And in partnership with the public schools, the school board passed a resolution. The district and United Way and potentially other partners will create the Santa Fe Early Learning Center at Agua Fria that will house the whole continuum of services for kids and their families.
Freeman expects that the center will offer comprehensive childhood services, including postpartum home visits for new parents, home visits for first-time families, child care, pre-kindergarten programs, and adult education classes and parenting workshops.
We see parents, adults, bringing children to this campus for a multitude of reasons. You know, they could be bringing them there for child care, and those children would be there all day. They could be coming to connect with a home visitor who would actually visit them in their homes mostly. They may be coming there to find out about resources. We certainly imagine that child care providers from across the community and outside of the community will be coming there for professional development and continuing education. So, you know, really kind of like the health plex idea, except the early childhood plex idea.
There are, of course, myths about why some Santa Fe students begin elementary school behind the curve.
And a lot of the reason that they're substantially behind is not because their parents aren't interested in them. You hear that. You know, not because their parents don't want to be involved with them. You hear that. It really is often because their parents are working two or three jobs and they don't have as much time.
Freeman says the Early Learning Center is modeled after the EduCare program created by the Buffett Foundation, and she says other communities have similar efforts in place.
There have been a couple of other cities that have been pretty successful in aligning early childhood services in a really impactful way. San Antonio is one of those. Miami-Dade in Florida is one of those. So we are definitely using learnings from, you know, all of those places.
Santa Fe School Superintendent Joel Boyd says the Early Learning Center, through community-wide collaboration, will build a path to kindergarten readiness for all children and establish a level playing field for Santa Fe's diverse student populations. SFPS Chief of Staff Latifa Phillips adds the district is seeking community support as it launches the effort.
Though our students may come to us at preschool, learning begins really much earlier than that, right, from birth. So it's an important initiative for the community to get behind and support if we value education and really want to increase the achievement in our district.
And the United Way's Catherine Freeman points out the early childhood effort plans to target Santa Fe County's most vulnerable preschoolers.
We see it as a resource for all of the Santa Fe School District, but really a resource for the Agua Fria Census Zone, where our most vulnerable children and families in Santa Fe live.
For KSFR, I'm Tom Trowbridge.
12:36 here in the KSFR newsroom, just past the bottom of the hour, and again, the perfect opportunity to spend 60 seconds with our resident curmudgeon, Christopher Hagen.
There surely has to be a reason for the existence of the Tea Party. I'm just not sure what that reason is. It appears that the Tea Party has a distinct dislike of the Affordable Care Act, known in some circles as Obamacare. I say we oblige them and don't let any Tea Party member be eligible for Obamacare. Matter of fact, let's give them their own country, like, say, Houston, where they can have their own president, Representative Cruz. To me, the Tea Party's destructive, obstructive agenda seems to be a sleeping cousin to the Libertarian Party, all of whom put a romantic hue on the days of yore when each person was free to pursue his or her own way, free to be plundered and pillaged and pummeled by anyone stronger and or smarter or less principled. Wikipedia defines tea as an aromatic beverage. I guess aromatic is one way of describing the Tea Party. For KSFR, I'm Christopher Hagan.
And with that, we'll conclude today's edition of At Noon, KSFR's extended noon news hour. Dan Garrity with you here at the news desk, with many thanks to my contributing colleagues today, Tom Trowbridge and Charles Maynard. We'll be back Monday with more news of and for New Mexico for you, and as always, we hope you join us.